And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also the 5th Annual Lost Pines Christmas Bird Count Weekend, hosting workshops for birding enthusiasts on Saturday, December 19th at the Hyatt Regency Lost Pines Resort and Spa near Bastrop, Texas. Workshops will be held and taught by experts from the University of Texas at Austin, Texas A&M University, the University of Southern California, and more. The official count takes place December 20th, and more information is available by visiting lostpines.com. We invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our feathered friends and our avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions tonight about birds. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks so much for joining us again this week.
Good evening.
So if you have any questions, feel free to call in tonight at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. We also welcome photos during the show. If you have a bird that you've taken a photograph of and you can't identify it or would like a little help or a little more about it, you can send those photos to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Cliff, let's go ahead and refresh our listeners about last month's conservation tip, which we always end our program with.
We talked about, you know, of course, we want to promote getting in the outdoors, but there's that sweet area we have to be careful of. So our topic last time was fish, swim, and play from 50 yards away. And that slogan is a great one. It reminds people, whether you're a photographer or you're fishing or you're birding or you're just boating, to especially sensitive nesting islands, what we call rookeries or heronries, you don't want to scare these birds off the nest. So give birds the space they need. If you flush these birds off the nest, it could be the middle of the day, super hot sun. You know, birds need to sit on their eggs, but that's not as hot as the sun beaming down on it. So actually, in the heat of the day, birds are keeping the eggs more regulated, a little cooler than the hot sun would cook them. So and also when we're walking the dogs on the beach, we like to let them loose and they run after the flocks of gulls and shorebirds. Well, some of those shorebirds may have just landed in migration and are, you know, their gas tank's on E and they're trying to refuel, and here they're having to fly again. So we're trying to remind people to be respective of birds and their needs and other wildlife too. So again, the slogan is fish, swim, and play from 50 yards away.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. Again, the number is 800-552-8502. Call us up and let us know what you think. And if you have any questions about birds, perhaps you're curious about what's going on in your backyard, you can give us a call and let us know. We're going to go ahead and go to our bird spotlight this month. We do one every month. And what is your bird spotlight for this month?
So last month we picked the great blue heron. And this month we're kind of keeping to the wetland theme. And I selected the wood duck. And let's listen to the wood duck here. The old-timer's name is Squealer, and that's perfect. What we're actually hearing there are the females. They make that loud squealing call, and people that have canoed or walked to the edge of the water and flushed and really hear the females squeal. The males make that soft, raspy jeeb call that you can hear in the background. It doesn't carry very well. So the female wood duck is the one that gets the name Squealer. The males are gorgeous. They're glossy purple and green, white. They have several other colors. I think most people are familiar with wood ducks. They're one of the few ducks that are capable of perching on a horizontal limb on a high up in a tree or a snag. They nest in hollow trees, old woodpecker cavities, or man-made nest boxes, while most ducks are ground nesting. Wood ducks are found in a variety of wetland habitats, including creek bottoms, swampy areas, lakes and ponds, and more. They were almost wiped out 150 years ago due to unregulated market hunting. And in the South, they suffered from year-round pressure because many individuals stay here all the year long. But they're doing much better nowadays. And not all of our southern wood ducks are year-round residents. A leg band retrieved from a hunter of a wood duck collected near Jacksonville, Texas in the 90s revealed that the bird was banded 4 years prior as a juvenile in southern Ontario, not far from Toronto. So think of that connection, Toronto to Jacksonville, Texas, and that bird was already 4 years old. So they are, some are migratory. Like most ducks, wood ducks are very omnivorous. They eat a variety of seeds and fruits and invertebrates that they find either on land or in the water. It's really only the mergansers in our area that are the true fish-eating ducks. A lot of people think that ducks eat fish, but majority of them do not. In the fall and winter, wood ducks eat a lot of acorns they find on the ground or floating in the water. And during the cooler months, some folks can sometimes flush these birds from dry ground because those ducks are feeding on mast under a grove of productive oak trees. So when you flush a wood duck from the ground, he's probably feasting on some acorns that are on the ground.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty neat.
You are listening to Bird Calls tonight with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. And we do have this sound and also a beautiful photograph of that wood duck up on our website tonight. That's at redriverradio.org. Just click on Bird Calls and you'll find all of this. Plus, we have a couple of photographs that were sent to us from Uncertain, Texas by Michaela Strong, who lives up there. And she had found these and, well, took these actually. They're a little bit on the dark side, but they were quick snaps. And you had passed these on. I'd passed these on to you. And we're going to go to the Mississippi Kites. There would be the next one.
Yeah. So do we remember who photographed these?
Yeah, that's Michaela Strong
that's
as well.
Okay.
Yep, same person.
Well, these are they're kind of silhouettes, but you can see enough of the bird to know that these are Mississippi Kites. And what's amazing is that they really pour through our listening area. They're here in Shreveport pouring through in migration. They really pour through over Nacogdoches where I live. August is a great month for that. They start tapering off here in September, but most any date in August is just full of these birds overhead. They look very graceful, flying with great ease, soaring around, and they're actually hunting for dragonflies and other aerial insects. They'll eat grasshoppers, moths, but they're really after dragonflies. And I think most people that have looked up have probably seen this bird wondering, what is that? And it's kind of a small raptor with pointy wings, looks very dark gray, and that's what is these pictures of one perch. And again, it's the Mississippi Kite.
Now you say they're migrating through the area. Where
yeah.
are they migrating from?
Most of them nest in the southern Great Plains, so Oklahoma, southern Kansas. And what's really interesting is that these birds are going to Central South America. Think about Bolivia and surrounding countries of Bolivia. That's where these guys are going, which is remarkable. And these birds might live 10 to 15 years and make that migration from, say, Oklahoma City to La Paz, Bolivia every year. It's just remarkable. And we are along that route. They like to follow waterways that have big trees that probably are on purpose. They're probably harboring these dragonflies that they like. If you look way up high, you can often see dragonflies. They're sometimes flying way high up in the canopy or above the canopy. And you can tell when the Mississippi Kite's after one because all of a sudden it stops doing this really loose circling and just dive bombs and like a bullet. And they'll grab it with their foot and eat it on the wing And, you know, it's not a whole lot of food from a dragonfly. So it's like us eating a Cheeto. We're going to eat a whole bag of Cheetos to get full, right? So they're eating a whole bunch of these dragonflies, and they're feeding along the way during migration.
Which now, are they raptors, and they eat other things? Do they eat small rodents and the like?
They don't eat a lot of rodents. They're not going to be able to catch those because they really like to catch things on the wing.
Okay.
So they will pluck baby birds from the nests in canopy nesting birds on occasion, but they're really going after invertebrates. The dragonflies are really the prime source, and other arthropods. So, but no, they're not going to be the kind that are eating the rats in the neighborhood. These guys are really catching stuff on the wing.
We'll leave that for the owls. So.
Yes.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our first call tonight. Bob from Nacogdoches is online. Bob, what question do you have for Cliff?
We have noticed within the last couple of days a bird that we have very amateurishly identified as a Baltimore Oriole.
Mm-hmm.
Is that highly unusual in the northern Nacogdoches County area?
Well, that's great that you saw one. They are pouring through right now, migrating through as southbound migrants. So that's really great that you got to see one. The was it a male? Was he just spectacular orange and black?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, there are two of them. And the strange thing was they seemed to be very social in respect to all of the cardinals and blue jays and woodpeckers and everything else that we've got around here. But they're especially attracted to our hummingbird feeders.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people don't like the orioles feeding on the hummingbird feeder because they can't sit there and hover at the feeder like a hummingbird. It's actually not sitting, of course, but hovering at the feeder. It sits on top of the feeder and drinks. And when it's sitting on top of the feeder, it's tipping it and the nectar spilling everywhere.
Right. Well, these appear to be very careful.
Ah.
And we've got four hummingbird feeders in the front and two in the back, and they alternate front and back. And just about an hour ago, the back feeders, each one of them had an oriole on
That's
it.
That's neat.
And they were just perched on there. But
yeah. Well,
quite a large number of our hummingbirds, they perch and eat too. So.
Right, right. And the hummingbirds, the ruby throats, are really pouring through right now. They're going to be peaking any minute now. The latter half of September is when they really peak, and that includes right now in the middle of the month. So that's neat. You've got the orioles coming too. So enjoy the orioles because they're not going to be around much longer. But they are southbound migrants, so those guys are headed to the tropics.
Okay.
And so you have a migrant there, and that's pretty neat. And no telling where that bird was born. I mean, it could have been Minnesota. Our northern residents like to put out grape jelly. Where the orioles breed, you'll see people put out grape jelly. They really devour that. I don't think I'd recommend that here. I think I'd just stick with the hummingbird feeder. And they do make a special oriole feeder that you can put nectar in if you don't like them tilting the hummingbird feeder, or you can just fashion your hummingbird feeder where it won't tilt and have two opposing strings to kind of keep it taut so it doesn't tilt. But it sounds like you're enjoying it, and I would too, because what a treat to have such a beautiful bird coming to your backyard like that. So that's the Baltimore Oriole. Yeah, and I love that orange and black. I think any color with black looks so good because it really makes the orange just look brighter and jumps out at you, and that's a really good bird. So very cool.
Well, I appreciate it, and we appreciate you traveling over to Shreveport for these frequent visits on the air.
Great, thank you, Bob.
We're some of your neighbors, and just outside the greater Appleby metropolitan area. So
okay, very good. Well, thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call, Bob. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. And if you have a photograph or a sound of a bird you'd like Cliff to identify, you can email those to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. We're going to go next to Mark from Shreveport. Mark, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hello. I really enjoy your broadcast when you're on there because I really get into birds a lot. But I wanted to ask you a question, if I could, about those Mississippi kites.
Uh-huh.
I've noticed that when you have a lot of Mississippi kites around, you don't have too many hawks around, you know, like hawks and stuff like that. Is there a reason for that?
Well, and I should have mentioned that some of our Mississippi kites stick around and breed here, especially along the Red River itself.
Right. Okay.
And so I think what they're doing, they're filling a different niche than many of the other hawks. I think you'll still have red shoulders in those creek bottoms. They're just different. They're not going to be as conspicuous, but you'll hear them, especially in the late winter through the spring. They're very loud with their crying calls. So I don't think there's any competition, if that's what you're thinking. I think
I was just kind of wondering because I've noticed, like, I raise pigeons, Columba forms.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering because a lot of times, like, when I see all these Mississippi kites around, I'll let my birds out, and it seems like there's less hawks in the area. But when the Mississippi kites seem to head on down south, I see more hawks.
Well,
at that time, I lock my birds up.
Right. Well, I think what we're also seeing there is a change of the season. So when the Mississippi kites go south, then all of a sudden we have a big influx of accipiters. Sharp-shinned hawk and Cooper's hawks, they'll spend the winter with us, and they would love to eat your precious Columbids.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you a lot of stories about Columba forms and hawks over the years. I've seen my birds just battle them. I mean, I've had hawks and my pigeons go at it. Like, I've had birds fall out of the sky like a rock to avoid hawks and stuff like that. But the reason why I called, I wanted to ask you about Columba forms, was the range of the white-winged dove. My sister lives in Austin, Texas, and every spring when I go to visit my sister, I see a lot of these white-winged doves. And I noticed last year in Bossier Parish, a lot of them over there. But I don't see very many in Caddo, but I do see a lot in Bossier Parish.
Yeah.
And I was kind of wondering if their range has extended that far now.
It sure has. If you look at the old literature for Texas, white-winged doves stopped. The most northerly they occurred with regularity was San Antonio. And something happened in the late 70s, early 80s. There was a cold snap. There were some weather changes. And I guess some just said, hey, the heck with this. Let's go exploring. And they found Austin. So you would not have found a white-winged dove in Austin in 1980 or even probably 85. But somewhere right around 85, I can't remember the exact date, they found Austin. They've exploded. Parks and Wildlife Parks and Wildlife has done some urban dove counts, and I think that the last estimate I saw, and it's probably 10 years old, there was an estimated 800,000 dove in the Austin area and over a million in San Antonio. I mean, they've just exploded. So the white wing has marched northward. They're now found in Canada. 20 years ago, that was unheard of. The Eurasian collar dove is another Columbid that's kind of falling maybe 10, 20 years behind the white-winged dove, and now they're marching north and spreading all over. So, yeah, in the last 30 years, we've got white-winged doves and Eurasian collar doves that are new to most areas, including your area here in Shreveport.
I had a friend of mine one time. He was a doctor. I'll tell you this quick story, and I'll let you go. He used to get the Eurasian ringneck dove and cross it with a Holman pigeon. Of course, they're in the same family.
Mm-hmm.
And the offspring, when they got older, of course, they coo. And the coo was unusual. The pigeon couldn't understand it, and the dove couldn't understand it.
Hmm.
And it was always kind of a thing to where the dove and the pigeon, he was always out of luck because he couldn't ever get a mate, it seemed like, when he was cooing. Because I guess the coo would be a little different, wouldn't it be?
Yeah,
it's a hybrid.
Yeah, it's a different critter, and probably wasn't singing the right tune, huh? Couldn't get a girlfriend.
We want to thank you for your call tonight, Mark. And you're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call in right now at 800-552-8502, or you can go online to redriverradio.org and send us an email as well at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com to send your emails. And if you have photographs or sound effects of any birds, we'd love to have those for our file one, and also we put them on our website. So we're going to go next to Phyllis from Graceland. Phyllis, you're online with Cliff. What's your call tonight?
For years, I had a little wren basket, and I kept trying to locate it in my yard where they would actually nest in it. And finally, this year, they did nest in it. And we didn't even notice it, and now they're gone. And I'm just wondering, do I clean the nest out of the basket for them to come back to it, or do I just leave it alone?
I would clean it out just because nest building is part of the courtship, part of the pair bonding of the bird. Also, that stuff will get all nasty with the humidity that we have. It'll get kind of mushy. So I would clean it out. Wrens might even, I don't know what structurally your basket looks like, but they might even use it in the cold winter months to roost in. So you might monitor it before you clean it out, but I would say certainly clean it out before mid-March-ish, somewhere in there.
Because probably leave it during the winter, you think?
Maybe, yeah. They might want to use it, but just kind of monitor it. You'll know, because right at dusk, they'll go in there and sleep. But wrens are funny. We my family and I really like to watch our wrens, and they have several bedrooms. And so they'll use a breezeway we have up in a little part of the breezeway up about 8 feet up. They'll sleep. They'll sometimes sleep in a basket that we have. They just move around, and I'm sure that's a way to maybe fool predators. But it is pretty interesting. They might use it maybe 6 or 8 nights in a row, and then we won't see them at that one spot in the breezeway for another couple weeks. It's just, I've never really tallied when they're there, but it's not every night. And if you've ever seen a Carolina wren asleep, they look just unbelievably different. They don't even look like a bird. I've had some people explain they look more like a mammal. They fluff up, they hide their head, they have these white spots on their back, and it looks like this spotted creature asleep that's just sitting there. But it's a puffed up thing, and they're really cute. So I've had people say it's a spotted bat, because there is such a critter, but it's not.
Right,
it's just a Carolina wren tucking his head on its back, sleeping and puffing up, showing these white spots, and they're really cool. So I really like the Carolina wren.
Yes.
Yeah, and Bill just played the song of the Carolina wren. Let's listen again. And I think most backyards have that one singing.
Yes. Yeah, and they wake you up in the morning, too.
Yeah,
yes, they do.
Sometimes before the alarm.
Thank you so very much.
Okay, thanks, Phyllis.
The thing is, if you get up early to have coffee at that sunrise time, they're actually quite beautiful to listen to.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to sleep in, forget about it.
Right,
exactly. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have phone lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. A quick question online from Doyle from Texas wants to know if a toucan would make a suitable pet for an adult.
I would never recommend a toucan as a pet. It shouldn't even belong in a cage. So my answer, quick answer, is no. I would say heck no. No, get a parakeet, a zebra finch. There's tons of those. They're easy. Toucans, there's just too much going on conservation-wise where they're from. And they're very particular. They've got special needs with fruits. I wouldn't do it. No, get a parakeet or a zebra finch.
Yeah,
is my
the sad
final
part
answer.
Is a lot of birds like that just are not meant to be cooped up. They languish and die.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And toucans, for the most part, are fairly social. A lot of species occur in family groups. or at least pairs. And that's right, I wouldn't recommend a single especially. So there are a couple of them at the Ellen Trout Zoo in Lufkin. I think that's a spectacular place. They've got two of them, and that's where a lot of people can see them. But for people to start taking them home, I'm not all for that. So my opinion is no.
Right. Yep. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have phone lines open at 800-552-8502. Or you can send us an email to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Obviously, we prefer the phone calls. And we've got one now from Mary from Ola, Louisiana. You're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
My question is, if some of it was answered with the first person on Oreos. I had the orchard Oreos, and they were constantly drinking out of the hummingbird feeders. Is that what they do? They don't eat seeds?
No, they. I think the hummingbird feeder is kind of like the Dairy Queen Blizzard. You know, you can't live on the blizzard, but boy, it sure is good every now and then, right? So no, they're still out eating insects. It's the primary thing they're eating. They're eating a lot of fruits, but the hummingbird feeder is just extra sweet flavor. So no, it's going to be a small portion of their diet. So the first caller was on Baltimore Oriole, and that's neat that you brought up a second species, the orchard Oriole. That's the one that stays in our listening area here in fairly good numbers.
Yeah, I haven't seen them now for about a month.
Yeah, they leave. They're gone, but they're one that will stay with us all summer long. The Baltimore Oriole will nest very, very rare and local in the listening area, but orchard Oriole is fairly widespread in the listening area as a breeding bird. Easy to find in June and July, especially when you learn their song.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mary. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. And we do have an emailed in question. This is from Ross. He lives in Monroe, but he's working on a platform out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. Noticed a flock of hummingbirds that flew and landed near the platform during a rainstorm. And he wanted to know, is this common behavior for hummingbirds to migrate straight over the Gulf?
Yes, a lot of hummingbirds do migrate over the Gulf, especially in the spring. The majority of them are in a mad dash to get over here, and the quickest way is to go over the Gulf instead of around the Gulf. And in the fall, there are a lot more individuals that do fly around the Gulf, but there are some that do fly over the Gulf. And the rainstorm is going to be an issue.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to fly when your feathers are wet, when you've got some wind. And so a platform probably saved their lives, you know, before humans built those. Those hummingbirds would have been fish food. They would not have made it all wet and cold. So what he needs to do is really watch for other birds landing there. And if he's stuck out there and on the oil rig in the spring, oh, man, I would love to be out there with him, say, the last 2 weeks of April, first 10 days or so of May. That should be the window he ought to request working out on the rig. So let's say April 15 to May 10, I would work that window with him and watch all the warblers and vireos and orioles that are flying past. Some might be taking refuge there and resting. There are a lot of predatory birds that realize that too. So you'll see peregrines and gulls camping out waiting for these migrants that are much smaller and tastier, that are weak and easy to catch. But yeah, I want to go out there this spring with him. So hopefully Ross is watching for migrants.
Maybe that'll be your birding trip this spring.
That would be neat.
Ross, ask for a combat pay. Tell him it's too trauma and get that extra pay for that.
That's right. And the good thing about that window I mentioned, April to May, there are no hurricanes. That's not the hurricane season. So a little safer in that regard. Right now, I don't think I'd want to be out there. This is prime hurricane season.
Definitely.
But think about those migrants. They're flying through. Mm-hmm. They've got to deal with hurricane seasons as well. It's pretty remarkable.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist with the Texas Park and Wildlife Department, a position he's held for more than 17 years. We want to thank those folks there for letting us have Cliff for tonight. We're going to go next to Dennis from Leesville. Dennis, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thank you very much for the call. I enjoy the show.
Great. Thanks, Dennis.
My call is going back to the wood ducks you talked about earlier.
Uh-huh.
I have a wood duck box on a small pond, and they nest every year, but I never see any babies when they hatch on the water. Could you explain that?
Yeah, they're very secretive. So they're what we call precocial young. Within a day or two of hatching, they are ready to go. And so if you're not there, it's usually a morning thing. If you're not watching on the morning that they fledge, that mom is going to hop down in the water. She's going to call incessantly to them saying, come on, kids, come on. And one at a time, and it might be 10, 12 or more eggs that turn into little fledglings, they'll jump out of there, a little ping pong ball, fuzzy ping pong ball. So I think what's happening is if you really have to monitor when they lay those eggs to start the clock and know that, and I can't remember if it's 28 or 30 days later, they're going to hatch. And if you're not ready for it, you'll miss it. And that's probably what happened. So that she calls them, they jump out, and then they swim off and march away. So they're not going to necessarily hang out at your pond. They're going to try to walk down in the woods and find a creek, maybe find a swampy area, not be out in that open pond where we see them all the time. They're trying to, you know, get hidden and secretive so those young can grow and not be just really conspicuous, because everybody wants to eat a young baby bird, especially a wood duck. Yeah.
That's why I haven't ever seen them. And they must go down into the woods and then hide, I reckon.
Yeah, a trick to do is, and a colleague, a coworker, an office mate of mine, Howard Williamson, he's done this, he's perfected it, and he puts out a camera. And so he's gotten camera pictures of those birds, and within 10 minutes or so, all the young have jumped out, and then another 10 minutes, they've all swam off.
10 minutes after they've hatched?
No, I'm talking about from the first one jumping out to the last one. It's a real quick order of them jumping out. So they've only hatched a day or two, and they're gone. So maybe what you ought to do is set up a camera. You can set up a game cam, maybe, if you can keep it where it's not going to disturb the birds, but you want it also to be close enough where the young can trip it. Or you can do like Howard, my buddy, and he knows on the calendar when they're going to hatch. Is it going to be there this Friday or next, or the next day, Saturday? And he gets his camera going, and he doesn't miss it because he gets it on film. And that's just as enjoyable, I think, to watch it on film than in real life. So so that's what's happening. They are trucking out of there. That's just the nursery, and they're never going to come back to that. Yep.
Well, thank you very much. And like I say, I enjoy the show.
Great. Thank you, Dennis.
So really, their time in the nest is very, very short. They don't need much.
Yeah. Once they've hatched out of the egg and they've become a fledgling, they're no longer an egg. They're not a nestling for long. So nestling is a term. It's a bird out of the egg sitting in a nest. But no, they're less than 48 hours. They're in that stage. So they're precocial. And that's very typical of certain birds. A lot of our gallinaceous birds like quail and turkey, they do the same thing. But so many other birds are what we call altricial. And those are birds that really utilize the nest for long periods, and they're true nestlings for a long time. So vireos, cardinals, woodpeckers, hawks, these things. More birds are altricial than precocial, meaning they stay in the nest for long periods.
Well, I was thinking of years ago, we had a chance to actually film from start to finish the laying of a peregrine falcon. The nesting, the building of the nest, the laying of the eggs, and then the amount of time that they spent in the nest was fairly lengthy.
Yeah, it's probably, I don't have that stuff in front of me. We don't Google anything, so I'm guessing 45 days or so that young bird is going to stay there, and then they'll start what we call branching when they're out of the end of the limbs, past the nest, and start flapping and building up their muscles and their encouragement to finally take flight. But it takes a while longer for bigger birds like a bald eagle.
Right,
they take a long time as a nestling. But a wood duck is one of the opposite extreme. They don't need the nest for very long.
Yeah.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he is here to answer your calls tonight. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You can email sounds, questions, or photographs at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. We're going to go next to Kelly from Alexandria. Kelly, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
A couple of questions. One, did I hear you correctly earlier when you said that people cannot live on blizzards alone?
Maybe I should have said shouldn't live.
Oh, okay. Well, that might explain my weight problem. I moved into a new home back in March, and on the downspout of the gutter, there was a nest already there, so I didn't mess with it. And within a couple of weeks or months, there was a dove.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it hatched one dove. And then it seems like maybe a week or so later, I saw a dove back on the nest. And I thought, well, I wonder why she's back on the nest. And actually, I guess it was a second crop of dove.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my question is, was it the same dove, or do dove share nests?
Well, first of all, dove build crappy nests. I don't know if it was a mourning dove or not, but they build the worst nest. It's like they're drunk when they're building it. You know, you'd think you could spend a little more time weaving it together, making it look firm and tight, but they're just several twigs just plopped it down, and they hope for the best. So to get to your question, it could be the same bird. It's hard to know without individually marking birds, but we do know that that mourning doves can really spit out young. They can breed up to 5 times in a calendar year, the same pair, and that's including colder months. When you wouldn't think that birds should be nesting, doves are prolific. So I think that's why white-winged doves are doing so well. They just can breed a lot. Same with Eurasian collar doves. But I think the mourning dove is the most interesting because they'll nest up to 5 times in a year. So, yeah, I'm guessing it's probably the same bird. But the architecture, they need to work on that. But obviously it's working because we've got still quite a few mourning doves out there.
This particular nest was it almost appeared to have mud included in it. So I don't know if it was built by another species and they just took it over. Like I said, I've just been there since March.
Right.
I'll keep an eye out on it.
Yeah, the downspout sounds like a recipe for disaster. Would a big 2-inch, 3-inch rainstorm would that have flushed the nest out?
No, it's actually underneath the fascia board or the overhang of the roof.
Okay.
So it's on that you know maybe 20 or 30 degree slant from the gutter down to the wall.
Okay.
So it's underneath the
eave.
Cover of the roof.
And
the eave.
And probably great placement because who's going to climb up there? Snake, cat, anything else that loves eggs and babies? That's a really good place to put a nest, isn't it?
It is. And,
yeah.
And there's a little tree right probably 10 feet away that has two or three nests in it.
Uh-huh.
None of which that I saw were active this year. So like you said, a cat certainly couldn't climb up the metal gutter. I guess a snake could if anybody would.
But yeah.
It was just interesting to see that there was multiple
uses. Yeah, yeah, and if they like it, they'll be back, and they're not going to expend much energy building a nest again because they just make really cruddy nests.
I'll be doing it.
Yeah.
One last question.
Uh-huh.
I'm intrigued about the hummingbird migration. I was aware that they crossed the Gulf of Mexico. Would it be advantageous for the gentleman on the oil rig to put feeders out there if that was allowed?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Certainly it would be. You know, the platform's already out there. We're already you know, toying with nature, so to speak. So yeah, I think that would be a good idea. And I wonder if a lot of those oil rig guys are already doing something like that. But yeah, that would be a fantastic idea to put out a feeder. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So maybe Ross on the oil rig is listening and can do that.
Well,
good
great.
Idea.
Thank you for your time. I think I'm going to go get a blizzard.
Thanks for your Kelly. Call tonight. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight. We do have lines open, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to next to Tom from Hallsville, Texas. Tom, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, I'm not originally from this area. I'm from Arkansas, and when we first moved here about 25 years ago, we noticed a lot of black colored birds in the all the malls in the Dallas area.
Mm-hmm.
And I determined there's probably some kind of grackle. I'm not sure. We don't have them in Arkansas.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the great-tailed grackles, and they really like shopping centers year-round. They're in big numbers. You mentioned Dallas. They're in the big cities. They've recently colonized my town, Nacogdoches, 20-something years ago. They were impossible to find, and now we've got a couple of resident
and they have a long
nesting.
Tail.
Yeah, they have a long tail. They're the males are a dark, glossy black. When the sun hits it, it's very purpley, glossy, green and blue, real pretty. And the female is a flat brown, and she's not as long-tailed. So those are great-tailed grackles, and I suspect they're moving up into Arkansas. Depending on where you're from, I bet you they'll be there soon if they haven't already found it. So they're inching northward too, like the white-winged dove we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, that was my original question. Uh-huh. Because we only saw them in Dallas, and I live in Hallsville, which is about 125 miles towards Shreveport, and now we've got them in Longview, and in this area, they're all over the place in the shopping center, Walmart shopping centers, and in the malls, and just okay. When we first saw them, they had the long tails. Now we were out there today, and it looked like they all got haircuts. None of them have long tails anymore.
Yeah, they're molting. Yeah, that's cool. And I forgot about that. I'll see male great-tailed grackles this time of the year flying by, and they look like little squatty Nerf footballs because they've molted all their tail feathers. And not every individual's doing that. Some will have a few scraggly feathers left. But so what you're seeing is annual molt. So feathers are very light and sturdy, but they still can't survive the life of a bird. So birds have to molt those at least once, sometimes twice a year, depending on the bird. But that's what you saw, is the annual molt of the tail feathers of the great tail grackle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot, Tom. We appreciate that. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And the reason I asked is we did have an online question. Somebody from Nacogdoches, Paul, wanted to know what kind of bird, they have long tails, that he keeps seeing eating insects around Walmart. So I'm assuming that's probably in the same vein.
Yeah, that's the great-tailed grackle. They've done well with urbanization. They have followed humans. They do well with what we do. They like our parking lots. They like our mowed lawns. They like the shade trees that we put near lighted parking lots. They feel very comfortable roosting in those trees and nesting in those trees. And NAC, you can see them in the big box store parking lots on the north side of town. Yep, and they're here to stay. They really like urban areas. Although the ones in NAC we found, they typically leave in the dead of winter. So they disappear sometime in December. And reappear about 3-4 months later. So they don't stay with us year-round. But if you go to other cities in Texas, especially in the valley, like McAllen, up to Corpus, and even up on the coast up to Houston, they are there year-round, and they are in immense numbers. And they're roosting in those parking lots, and you don't want to park your car under that favorite roost tree, because it will all of a sudden have little white polka dots on it.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls, and we've got a full bank of calls, so we're going to go to our next caller tonight, Marcia from Kilgore. Marcia, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I kind of have a two-part question about hummingbirds. We usually only have maybe three or four every summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you see all these videos where there's just dozens and dozens on all these feeders, but of course we don't put out a bunch like that. But ours chase each other off. They never feed at the same time. When one's on there, the other one will come up and, you know, they just scream at each other.
Yeah.
and fly away. And, you know, they never seem to eat at the same time. What's up with that?
Well, in the breeding season, they're a lot more territorial, so you won't see them sharing as much in migration. I've been down to Rockport, Texas, where the annual fall hummingbird festival occurs. I think it's the third weekend of September, so that should be coming up. And you can go on these home tours and see feeders just completely ringed with ruby-throated hummingbirds, and another ring outside of that of birds waiting to get their turn. So in migration, they're a lot more tolerant. And that's what you're seeing with ruby throat. Now, other species are more tolerant. So if you go out west Texas near the town of Cristobal, near San Angelo, I've got a friend there, Dan Brown, and he feeds black-chinned hummingbirds. And all summer long, he can get those kinds of numbers that you're talking about. And those are black-chins. But our ruby throats, I think what you're seeing is just a different behavior based on the season. So, in the breeding season, they're going to be a lot more territorial. And in the migration, they're just happy to get a drink and move on.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the other question I had about that was, this is kind of a little disagreement between my roommate and I about, she thinks the ones that come back every year are the exact same ones that were here the year before. Is that even possible, or do you think that's true?
It's possible, but without individually marking the birds, we'll never know.
Right.
So I'd call it a tie. You don't need to go. You don't need to go up on her rent as your roommate.
All right. Well,
great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marcia.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist. We do have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Greg from Martinsville, Texas. Greg, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, guys, just an odd observation I had yesterday driving on 95 in between Martinsville and Garrison. In the distance, probably 100 yards off, on the road, you know, just on the ditch of the road, there was a couple what I thought were buzzards. And as we got closer, my son and I were driving, as we got closer, they picked up and they had white tails and white heads. And they were, I mean, we came close to hitting them. There were two bald eagles on the side of the road, and I'd never seen them on the side of the road or together. I didn't know that they were scavengers. Is there some kind of season that's going on? I'm just not familiar with their habitats and what they do. We see them periodically flying around the house and flying. There's a lake right there, a private lake, about 10 miles west of Martinsville on 95.
Right.
But they were just sitting on the side of the road. And as we came by with the car, we scared them up. And I mean, it was a good thing I didn't hit them, obviously. But I mean, it was a close call. And they were
right
on the ground in the ditch.
Well, before you mentioned bald eagle and you were explaining what you saw, before you said bald eagle, I was thinking caracara. And that's a bird that has been very spotty in our area and not real consistent, but have shown up in areas and just disappear. And they do what you explained as well. So I think most people know what a bald eagle looks like. But
I mean, I was literally 3 feet away from
okay.
it. When I passed it, it looked like, you know, the picture of a bald eagle.
Yeah.
It was a bald. It was a white, solid white head and solid white tail, and majestic as could be. And heck, I wanted to salute. You know.
Yeah. Cool. No, bald eagles do eat roadkill. That's actually a problem. There have been several bald eagles that have been hit and not killed, but had to be rehabbed, and some of those never made it. The wing had to be removed, so it's really dangerous. But they will feed on deer carcasses. They'll eat on fish carcasses on the edge of lakes. Bald eagles, you know, even though they're majestic to a lot of us, boy, Ben Franklin, he really was pushing for the wild turkey to be our national emblem. He thought that was a much more spectacular bird, and he and others kept commenting how the bald eagle is kind of a klepto. They steal fish from osprey. They steal food from other birds. They'll be eating on dead things. And it's not unheard of that bald eagles will do that, but we don't think of them being scavengers. But I mean, when there's fresh venison and you've been eating fish for the last 10 months, I think it's good to have a variety, maybe wash it down with a blizzard. How about that?
There you go. All right, we've got three calls on deck right now, so we're going to move along here at Bird Calls, and we're going to go next to Jim from Martinsville, Texas. Jim, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call, years ago, I used to live in Kentucky, and I had a house out there, and what I'd call barn swallows. And, of course, I'd sit out there and watch them under the carport where they built their nest. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, is that a mating couple that would return each year, or would that possibly be some of the offspring, maybe, or something, some other group completely?
Yeah, it's hard to know if that's Mildred and Bob returning every year. Unless we mark these birds, we really don't know. If someone said they had 25 years of this, I could pretty much guarantee they weren't Bob and Mildred. Mm-hmm. Just because they don't live that long. So it's hard to know if those were the same swallows, but they're all looking for a nice covered area. They'll use culverts, bridges, overpasses, building sides, under porches, and like you said, under your carport. There's two kinds that nest here with great regularity, the barn swallow and the cliff swallow. And no, that second one was not named after me, but I'd like to think it was. And you can tell by the architecture who built it. So if it's an open cup-shaped nest made of mud, it's the barn swallow. If it's a gourd, completely round with just a little hole on the side, that's the cliff swallow. So, but it's just hard to know, Jim, if those are the same birds. I mean, we'd all like to think that. And I would think for, you know, several years, 4 or 5 years, it could be. But these swallows, it just depends on how healthy they are, but there are certainly going to be more swallows to replace yours, and that's a good thing, because swallows do good things for us. They're keeping a lot of those pesky insects in check.
We're going to try to get to one or two of our final calls. We're going next to Gerald from Longview. Gerald, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
No, this is Judy.
Okay, this is Judy. All right, they had the lines mixed up on me. What's your question tonight?
I was just wondering, going back to hummingbirds, I have the ruby-throated territorial ones, like the other caller.
Uh-huh.
But my question, how do I keep the ants out of the hummingbirds here? And the birds won't drink if there are ants there, is that right?
Yeah, you can get look online for a hummingbird feeder that has a little moat, and you can fill that with a little vegetable oil that they won't cross. It kind of provides a little barrier. Or you can get something at your nursery, your plant nursery, called Tanglefoot or Tangle Trap, but I would not use that liberally. It's really sticky stuff. It's like Vaseline. And you can put that on the string, put it pretty far from the feeder because you don't want the hummingbird to bump into that stuff. It's a sticky nightmare mess, but it'll keep your ants away. You have to keep reapplying it because the ants will die in it, and then another ant will walk on top of him and get a little closer. He'll die and so forth. And if you can imagine a bridge of ants eventually over that tanglefoot, so you want to reapply it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we want to thank all of our callers tonight, and we do have one final online question. A caller from Woodville, Texas, saw a bird that was about 2.5 foot tall with chocolate colors, saw it pick up a cat and fly off with it, and wanted to know what kind of bird this might be.
Well, I would say if it was dusk, a great horned owl might do that. If it was really daylight, a red-tailed hawk might do that. So without a photograph, it's hard to know. So I'm not sure.
All right. And finally, Cliff, you always close out with a conservation tip of the month. And what do you have for us this month?
Yeah, this month we're going to talk about the duck stamp. We're going to tie it back to earlier in the episode, we profiled the ever-popular wood duck. If you want to know one of the easiest and best ways to contribute to the conservation of wood ducks and dozens of other wetland inhabiting birds, buy a duck stamp and do so annually. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, issues the duck stamp. It's not intended for postal use, but instead is intended to protect wetlands across the country. Since the stamp's inception in 1934, over 6 million acres of wetland habitat in the U.S. have been purchased or leased for wildlife to a tune of around $800 million. There's very little overhead with the duck stamp, and that's good news because only 98 cents out of every dollar is used directly to protect wetlands with the duck stamp. For the longest time, the duck stamp was $15. Many conservation groups pushed to get that increased to coincide with the rising prices of purchasing land. So this year, the stamp is now $25. To buy one, most post offices carry them, as do places that sell hunting and fishing licenses. You can buy one at home online from, if you live in states like Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, they offer the sale of these stamps online. The stamp is not just for duck hunters, it's for bird watchers, nature lovers, hikers, and wildlife photographers alike. Showing the stamp will get you into any national wildlife refuge in the country. For example, birders looking for the whooping crane at Aransas National Wildlife Refuge near Rockport, Texas, need the stamp to enter. By the way, that refuge was purchased in 1937 thanks to funds generated by the duck stamp. And that was about 4 years before the world population of whooping cranes plummeted to just 15 individuals. So the duck stamp makes a great gift. Consider getting one for the wildlife enthusiast in your family. If you want to do more, buy two duck stamps for yourself and be sure to buy them each and every year because our wetland birds will thank you for it.
All right, Cliff, I want to thank you for joining us tonight and being our resident ornithologist and expert on ornithology.
Great, I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Had a great show tonight. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and he is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, as well as the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this show. And I want to personally again thank Cliff for joining us tonight. Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, as well as the 5th Annual Lost Pines Christmas Bird Count Weekend, hosting workshops for birding enthusiasts on Saturday, December 19th at the Hyatt Regency Lost Pines Resort and Spa near Bastrop. Workshops will be taught by experts from the University of Texas at Austin, Texas A&M University, and the University of Southern California, and more. The official bird count takes place December 20th, and more information is at visitlostpines.com. visitlostpines.com. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next here on Red River Radio. Then on Tuesday, October 20th, we'll have our next edition of What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, and Cliff will return on November 17th at 6 p.m. for our next bird calls. We want to thank everybody for calling in again tonight. This program is produced by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford with help from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. And the audio will be posted in a couple of hours on our website at redriverradio.org.